नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। We're reading today from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, Chapter 11, The Perfect Society, Four Social Classes. And it's a text. I'll be reading a few texts, but we'll chant text 26. Samarjana, Samarjana Palepabhyam. Griha Mandana Vartanai Swayam Cha Mandita Nityam Parimrishtra Parichada Samaucha Vachai Sadvi Prasrayena Damenacha Vakyai Satyai Priyai Premna Kale Kale Bhajat Patim. Translation. A chaste woman must dress nicely and decorate herself with golden ornaments for the pleasure of her husband. Always wearing clean and attractive garments, she should sweep and clean the household with water and other liquids so that the entire house is always pure and clean. She should collect the household paraphernalia and keep the house always aromatic with incense and flowers, and must be ready to execute the desires of her husband. Being modest and truthful, controlling her senses, and speaking in sweet words, a chaste woman should engage in the service of her husband with love, according to time and circumstance. And I'll read, chant and read text 28. Santushta lalupa daksha dharma gya priya satyavak apramata suchi snigdha patim tvat patitam bhajet. Translation. A chaste woman should not be greedy, but satisfied in all circumstances. She must be very expert in handling household affairs and should be fully conversant with religious principles. She should speak pleasingly and truthfully and should be very careful and always clean and pure. Thus, a chaste woman should engage with affection in the service of a husband who is not fallen. Report by Srila Prabhupada. According to the injunction of Yajnavalkya, an authority on religious principles, Ashudhe Sampratiksho Hi Mahapataka Dushitaha, one is considered contaminated by the reactions of great sinful activities when one has not been purified according to the methods of Dasa Vidha Samskara. In the Bhagavad Gita, however, the Lord says, Namam Duskritino Mudha prapadyante naradamaha. Those miscreants who do not surrender unto me are the lowest of mankind. The word naradama means non-devotee. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also said, Ye bhaje se bada abhakta hina chara. Anyone who is a devotee is sinless. One who is not a devotee, however, is the most fallen and condemned. It is recommended, therefore, that a chaste wife not associate with a fallen husband. A fallen husband is one who is addicted to the four principles of sinful activity, namely illicit sex, meat eating, gambling, and intoxication. Specifically, if one is not a soul surrendered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he is understood to be contaminated. Thus, a chaste woman is advised not to agree to serve such a husband. It is not that a chaste woman should be like a slave, while her husband is Naradhama, the lowest of men. Although the duties of a woman are different from those of a man, a chaste woman is not meant to serve a fallen husband. If her husband is fallen, it is recommended that she give up his association. Giving up the association of her husband does not mean, however, that a woman should marry again and thus indulge in prostitution. If a chaste woman unfortunately marries a husband who is fallen, she should live separately from him. Similarly, a husband can separate himself from a woman who is not chaste according to the description of Shastra. The conclusion is that a husband should be a pure Vaishnava and that a woman should be a chaste wife with all the symptoms described in this regard. Then both of them will be happy and make spiritual progress in Krishna consciousness. Santushtado lupa daksha dharma gya priya satya bak apramata shuchi snigdha patim tvan patitam bhajat. A chaste woman should not be greedy, but satisfied in all circumstances. She must be very expert in handling household affairs and should be fully conversant with religious principles. She should speak pleasingly and truthfully and should be very careful and always clean and pure. Thus, a chaste woman should engage with affection in the service of a husband who is not fallen. Here we have Yudhishthira, and he's inquiring from Narada. Again, this is the Rajasuya sacrifice. And upon seeing who was killed? Shishupal. Upon seeing Shishupal killed by Krishna, and seeing the soul of Shishupal enter into the body of Krishna, Yudhishthira was quite amazed by this, and he began to inquire what happened here. So Narada was there, and he was the right person to approach. And that led to the discussion of Prahlad Maharaj and Lord Narasimhadev. And then it begins to go into a discussion of Dharma. And this is a wonderful thing to see, because Yudhishthira is known as Dharmaraj, the king of Dharma. He knows Dharma so well, not only theoretically, but the level that he lived Dharma on is just unparalleled. So why is he inquiring about Dharma? People should be inquiring from him about Dharma. But we can see that he never seemed to believe that he understood it fully. He always seemed to think that he had more to learn about it. We see it here. We see it at the end of the battle of Kukshetra, when seeing the results of that battle, he was feeling very despondent. And so he went, and practically most of all of his elders were dead. So he found that one elder who wasn't, who was lying on a bed of arrows, Bhishma Dev, and he went out to him, and then he began to inquire about Dharma. So we see many circumstances where Yudhishthira, although knowing so much and exemplifying it so much, felt himself that he didn't actually understand it so completely. And Dharma is actually a very difficult thing to understand, and that's actually what Bhishma would tell him. But it's so important for us to hear this, because the Dharma Shastras are there. They give us guidance. But human life is a very complicated affair. And it gets very difficult to understand sometimes. So what Srila Prabhupada is doing in this commentary is something interesting. He's showing us that here's this very nice verses describing a wife and her activities and her mentality, and how they should be very pure and very pleasing. But Srila Prabhupada also understands that beyond the positive message of this verse, that if we approach it in the wrong way, it can actually mislead us. So he's very carefully focusing on one word, actually. This word here is apatitam, who is not fallen. Right? I guess apatita means fallen, so apitam, one who's not fallen. And he's saying, take note of this word, because if the husband is fallen, then the whole instruction has to be understood in a different light. Dharma is meant to serve a purpose. It's actually meant to protect people, to sustain people. But the instructions on Dharma, if not very carefully applied, can serve the exact opposite effect. And Srila Prabhupada in a very interesting way has explained that in this commentary, because it says Yajnavalkya is explaining that one needs to be pure according to certain samskaras. And that's good. But what Krishna is saying in the Bhagavad Gita is that if one's not surrendered to Krishna, then they're fallen. And that this is actually the ultimate consideration that's brought into the equation. Whenever there are different rules or different regulations, we can understand that they're always meant to serve one purpose. And so Srila Rupa Goswami quotes this very wonderful verse. that always remember Krishna. Satatam smartavya vishnur vishvartam no najatu chit. That always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna. Sarve vidhi nasevasyor etayor eva kinkara. That all of them, all the different rules and regulations, they're seen as kinkara, they're servants. They're not the lords, actually. It's not that they're lords that we're meant to blindly surrender to, but actually they're meant to serve a higher purpose. And that higher purpose is to always remember Krishna, to never forget Krishna, to support our spiritual development in Krishna consciousness. And as long as the rules and regulations are serving that purpose, they're very good. And if ever they don't serve this purpose, then one has to reconsider their application and make an adjustment. So Srila Prabhupada in this purport, he's making an adjustment. And we have a tendency to actually, to see things through, when we see things through our own conditioning, we have a tendency to interpret them in a way that satisfies that conditioning. Right? We have Raghunath Prabhu here, staying in the temple with us now. And this commentary and just the situation described here reminded me of him and a circumstance some many years ago, actually. I had a friend who was a brahmachari. I was a brahmachari. This is maybe a long time ago, 20 years ago nearly. Now, Raghunath Prabhu, before he became a devotee, he was in a rock band. And he already had some reputation and was well known. And they taught nice kind of values about vegetarianism and kind of pure living. And then when he became a devotee, he was happy just to surrender and be a regular brahmachari. But actually, Gunagrahi Swami saw the potential for preaching that was there. That already he had a large following of young people who had some kind of desire to improve their lives through kind of a more pure lifestyle. And he said, if you just add Krishna into that, many of these young people can become devotees. So he did that, and they started another band, and that band developed a following, and so many devotees came from that. Now, I had another friend who was a brahmachari, and he also wanted to do this. He wanted to start a band, and he's saying, I can also do this and serve the same purpose. But perhaps his intention wasn't entirely pure, because in these bands you get a lot of glorification, and it can really serve the ego if one's not careful. So he wrote a letter to his Guru Maharaj, and he said, you know, I would like to start a rock band. I'm asking for your blessing. Please let me know if this is all right. I'm going to use it for preaching. I'm certain we can do this, and if you give me your blessings, I'm eager to take this up. Now, he received a reply, and he showed me the letter. And he and I viewed the letter in very different ways. I saw this letter, and more or less the letter was saying, yes, you know, Raghunath Prabhu with his band, he's doing wonderful service. But do take into account that, you know, he already had a popular following. He didn't have to go out and create a new following. And it's a very dangerous service. There are a lot of pitfalls that can come in one pass, whereas your life now as a brahmachari is very simple and it's a more direct path. And it was going on and on like this. It didn't say don't do it. But everything in that letter was leaning towards don't do it. So I saw this letter as, when I read that letter, I was thinking, oh, very clearly your guru doesn't want you to do this. He read that letter, and because it didn't say don't do it, he saw this as like a wholehearted kind of, almost that he was being ordered to do it. And so that desire was very strong in him, and it was clouding the way that he could understand the orders of his guru. So similarly, how we understand the orders of Shastra becomes clouded by our own desires, our own attachments. And due to that, it's often misused or misapplied. And rather than people being protected, it actually becomes a vehicle for cruelty. And I think in India this is common, and therefore Varnashram Dharma has been criticized so much. And even nowadays, from what I understand, like in villages, they have this panchayat, that's what it's called, this kind of group of elders. And often they'll make decisions that using Dharma Shastra that are not well considered and often cause great harm. And due to this, the more intelligent class of people not only rejects their interpretation, but rejects the Shastra entirely. And therefore, all the purpose of the instruction is lost. Not just the immediate purpose, but on a broader level, society begins to rebel against religion itself. Here we have Yudhishthira, and he's carefully inquiring. I want to understand this carefully. How should each of the Varnas operate? How should each of the... how should husband and wife operate? How should a leader operate? All in relation to each other. Because when we come... It's easy to consider Dharma theoretically, but when you bring it into the realm of society and human relationships, that's when all these things become so much more complicated. So this verse is nice because it's explaining that a woman should be all these nice things. She should be clean. She should be pure. She should be submissive. Her consciousness should be very pure. But if the husband's fallen, then all that is going to waste if she follows that person. That person will drag her down. If the husband's very Krishna conscious, then all these qualities are going to serve her so well. Now, as I mentioned, there's a tendency due to our attachments to see things in the wrong way. Now, this verse, if we read it in the United States, most people are going to have difficulty with this because they can't understand in the proper context. Right? A woman will read this and think, why doesn't the husband also keep the house clean? Right? And it's not an illogical type of thought. It makes sense. Actually, that society, certain values have been invested deeply in that society, right? Even from the very beginning of the country, there's one Declaration of Independence. Right? It's a Declaration of Independence from England at the time. And right at the beginning, it states that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they have these, given by God, by the Creator, they have unalienable rights. And among those rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Right. So it means I should have the right to live, no one should kill me, and I should have liberty, I should have freedom to pursue happiness in any way that I see, in any way that I desire. That, it was an important point to make, because, and actually the reason that it was made was because people wanted to live a particular dharma. People wanted to live a particular religious lifestyle, and which was often governments would make illegal. So the idea was you could come to this new place, you could settle down there and have the freedom to practice any religion you want. That was actually the motivation behind these kind of instructions. But over the years, that value of independence and freedom has become deeply instilled in the psychology of the people. And so any restriction on that is often viewed as unwanted. And particularly when rules are set and there's abuse, then there's a rebellion. So there's always goes from one extreme to another. If the Shastras are giving certain rules and we're seeing that there's a cruelty being done in the name of that, then let's reject the entire thing. And largely that's the situation you have in the United States right now. This verse would be, if I had to give this class to an American audience, I'd have to very, very carefully give most of the class would be building a context in which to understand this verse. And then at the end, it'd be explained. So now can you understand why this is good? Here, that's not as necessary, but still I think it's necessary, particularly in a city like Bombay. But a woman would see this verse and say, I can't appreciate this. I think a man should do the same. They should also be willing to clean. There's why should I? And then you can argue, well, men and women have a different psychology. They think differently. So it's not that one is better than the other, but they just both have differences and they can serve each other. And they'll say, well, no, those differences are only there due to the conditioning they've received because men have been ruling the whole time and then these differences have been built into the psychology, but it's not natural. And then we could argue, no, that it is natural. And we would never come to a conclusion, actually. It goes back and forth like this. But if we're not conditioned due to abuse, and if we can see very clearly, it's the most obvious thing that men and women have a different psychology. And it is a fact. It's not that one is better than the other. Both are very good. And when they operate together according to Dharma Shastras, then they both benefit, and all society benefits. The men benefit, the women benefit, their children benefit, and everyone else benefits. That's Dharma. It's meant to protect people. It's meant to sustain people. So that's one way that this verse can be seen. It's an explanation of how a woman should behave. And Srila Prabhupada is stepping in and saying, be careful how we understand this, be careful how we apply this. But this verse can be seen on another level too, that actually it cuts across all the different barriers of gender or any other barrier. And that is that really what's being described here is a pure soul. And there's actually a hint here we can understand that it's important for women to behave as described here, not only so that there can be smooth relations in society, but actually there's something even deeper that can be learned from it. What's being shown here is actually how the soul relates to God, because actually there's a parallel there. Right? We understand Krishna's Purusha, right? That he's male, and that all the jivas, in a sense, relate to him as a female, in the sense that, just as described here, we should be submissive, we should be pure. Right? If you read this verse, and you just change the context from woman and husband to jiva to the Lord, everything applies exactly the same. It says a chaste woman, we can say a soul should not be greedy, but satisfied in all circumstances. The soul should be very expert in handling all of their social affairs and should be fully conversant with religious principles. We should all speak pleasingly and truthfully and should be very careful to always be clean and pure. And thus, a pure soul should engage with affection in the service of the Lord. And you don't have to mention who is not falling here. But it's all the same thing. Our acharyas have carefully explained to us this, that actually there's this false conception that enters into the mind of the jiva when they come into contact with the material energy. And sometimes it's called Purusha Abhiman. It's the false conception of oneself as a male. So that applies not only to men, but actually to women as well. Because what it's saying is that the false conception is that we're the enjoyer. Right? We're the possessor. Ishvaraham aham bhogi. That misconception is our problem. And if we remove that from our consciousness and we adopt the consciousness, in a sense, of a female, of that to be enjoyed by God, that which is submissive to the Lord, that which is like wholeheartedly give oneself with full abandon, taking shelter of the Lord, that psychology is the proper psychology to approach God. And it's actually reality. Right? Take, for instance, Rukmini Devi's letter to Krishna. Right? It's a letter of a woman speaking to a man saying, I want to surrender myself to you. I want to become your property. I want to be possessed by you. So she wrote this very nice letter because she understood if very soon I'm going to be given to someone else. I want to be the sole property of Krishna. I want to belong to no one but him. I want to give myself in complete submissiveness to him. And I don't want to divert that to anyone else. So she took the opportunity to write this very beautiful letter, beautifully composed, and beautiful emotions are expressed from that. Now, it's a letter from a woman to a man. It's the psychology of a woman appealing to the psychology of a man, in a sense. But we can understand that letter is not just meant for women. That letter is meant for all of us. And that's why it's included there in the Bhagavatam, so that we can understand the psychology of how one surrenders to God. Right? With that kind of taking complete shelter, with that kind of helplessness, one says, dear Lord, I'm helpless. You know, I'm being diverted in so many directions, but I want to belong solely to you. So please come and take me away. that prayer is perfectly applicable to all of us. If we accept the meaning within that prayer and cultivate that and pray for that, that's actually our process. That's what we're trying to achieve. So when we see all these descriptions of this chaste woman, it's very nice. She's very clean and she's decorated herself, not for her own joy and not to attract anyone else, but solely for her husband. And she appears very clean, and then she has duties to perform. She takes them very seriously, and when they're done, they're pleasing. Right? If a husband walks in the house, just like I was thinking of when we went to this program the other night at the Birla home, as you're coming up the very beautiful driveway, there's all this jasmine hanging from the trees. And so as you're coming up that path, the smell is so beautifully fragrant, so sweet. It's nice. It's pleasing to the senses, but it also has a psychological effect, right? When you smell that, then kind of all the worries from the day sort of disappear, right? It kind of cleans the slate of the mind. And so when you sit down to hear, then the mind is set nicely for that. And therefore, the temple is kept very clean. It's essential, right? Here it's saying that the woman should keep the home very clean. In the same way, we should keep the temple very clean because it has a purifying and pleasing effect all of these rules and regulations, the reason that they're there is because the effect that they have on the mind. Right? All different kind of ritual, all the different types of religious practice, they're all carefully considered. Like if you go to Nectar Devotion and you see here are 64 practices of devotional service. Right? You can go through each and every one of them and understand that it's important because it has a direct and specific effect on the mind, right? That is conducive for surrender to the Lord or for meditation on the Lord, right? And actually, if you look at this and you compare to, take puja, for instance, what is puja? It's just a collection of rituals in one sense. Externally, it's just a collection of rituals that to a lot of people appear almost primitive. It's not in this. It's another thing that in the West is not easy to explain. For instance, like a Westerner's conception of worshiping a deity, they're going to base that either on things that they've heard from the Bible, which was kind of a condemnation of a kind of very primitive type of worship, or even from like some movies that they see where there's like some jungle people that are just worshiping something, and the whole message is that just see how foolish these people are. So it's not an easy thing to show. Here's an intelligent way that we can that one can adopt a process that has a very positive self-transforming effect. Right? But if you look at it carefully, really a lot of what's being described in this word is very much reflected in the process of puja. Like the very first thing you do in puja is you sit down. Actually, the very first thing, it really begins from the moment you wake up. Right? From the moment you get out of bed, first you put your right foot on the floor, not your left foot, and you offer prayer to Krishna. That's to respect Mother Earth. And then you offer prayers, Krishna, I'm yours. Dear Lord Narayan, I'm yours. Please bless me that every activity that I do through this day will be an offering to you. But when one sits down to actually perform the puja, there are different processes. But similarly, there's always this Bhuta Shuddhi, where one purifies their consciousness. And actually, there's a meditation where one feels that actually their entire body is transformed. Because we understand that this body is, like we say, it's a lump of ignorance and it's full of blood and so many impure substances. So when one's performing puja, they want to have the conception that actually I'm serving a pure body, right? A very clean body. So there's a mental conception of the transformation of the body, a body that's suitable to serve and please the Lord. Right? And then we pray that, you know, dear Lord, I'm not a Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. Right? I'm not any of these external designations. I'm simply the servant of the servant of the servant of the Lord of the Gopis. Right? All of these things are meant to affect our mind, to change its condition, or to, let's say, overcome its conditioning, and to bring us to our natural state where we're just like Rukmini, just fully surrendered, fully feeling full dependence with no desire except the desire of the Lord and to please the Lord. I believe yesterday's verse is saying how a woman should, or in the verse, and also Prabhupada elaborates in the commentary, she should be very much, it's speaking about the husband's vow. A husband has a particular vow, or let's say particular values or things that are important in his life to accomplish. And the woman shouldn't have something separate from that. It should serve that. Right? It should be in line with that and supportive of that. And if her mind is like that, then there's a very positive development. There's a very cohesive relationship, and it moves in a very beautiful and positive and pure direction. So similarly, if our mind is separate from the Lord, it's been conditioned in ways to think independently, then the process of puja is meant, first it's established that, no, we're dependent. And so consciously, different prayers and different meditations are there to bring the mind to that state. And in that state, we can begin to make offerings that are pleasing to the Lord. And if we don't do that, then we're just doing some, there's no meaning to the ritual. And it becomes an empty ritual. But if it's done, and if it's done consciously and carefully and thoughtfully and with devotion, then that externally to many meaningless activity or empty activity becomes so meaningful and so positive and so transforming to the consciousness and to the self. So this is the point, actually. We always have to try to look deeper to understand the essence, whether it's in the devotional practices that we do or whether it's in the application of Dharma in society as a whole. Right? We always have to understand, what is the purpose? Is the purpose being served? If the purpose being served, very good. If the purpose is not being served, carefully we have to understand through inquiring from those who have a deeper understanding, how do we apply this properly? In this particular complicated and difficult to understand circumstance, please help us understand, how is this properly understood? In Dharma, there's two considerations. There's Dharma within the activity itself, and there's also Dharma in the result of the activity. They have to be carefully considered. And usually in an immature state, we're preoccupied with the Dharma in the activity itself and maybe missing the understanding of how Dharma is, the more important is the Dharma in the result of the activity. Like the example of, I've read one very nice discussion on this from Hridayananda Goswami, and he describes this, how you take Bhishma, when he took his vow, right, very powerful vow, he wanted his father to be able to marry Satyavati. And her father was only going to do it if his son or his grandson would be the king. So Bhishma, understanding this, wanted to make a sacrifice for the pleasure of his father. And he took this vow that I'll remain brahmachari. Now, very good vow, very motivated nicely, good motivation behind that. It was reflective of his selflessness. But then in the future, complicated circumstance arose, right? That was a Vichitravirya, who was meant to be king, died young. Now what to do? Right? So Satyavati approached Bhishma and said, please, you have a child through his wives, and that way the line of kings can go on. And his response to that was that he would never break this vow. And he goes on and on about this, that if the light of the sun, if there's, comes to an end, and if the taste in water comes to an end, and all these different things, still I will not break my vow. Even if the universe should collapse, I will not break my vow. Right? Not that we're here to judge Bhishma in his decision, but the point is that he was more concerned with the Dharma and the activity, and he wasn't concerned with the Dharma and the result of the activity. Right? Now, later on his deathbed, when Yudhishthira comes to him and inquires, his approach is different. And actually, he says Dharma is very complicated. And he gives two examples. One was of a hunter named Balaka, who he was a hunter, which is not a very nice way to support oneself. But it was all he knew. He was doing it for one sole purpose, and that was to support his family. He had a blind father, and he had a wife and children to support, parents to support. This is what he knew how to do. So it's described that actually internally he was a very selfless person. Externally he had this horrible activity that he needed to do to support himself. And one day he saw one animal. It was some kind of beast he had never seen before, and it was blind. It said it was using its nose as its eyes. And seeing that beast, he immediately shot it with an arrow, killed it. And when that happened, flowers rained down from heaven, and a flower, Vamana, came down and to take him away. And the reason was, he didn't know it, but that beast was actually some person who created, did severe austerity to receive a boon, and that boon was basically just to terrorize people in general. So by killing that beast, he did a great service. And because his intentions were always pure, he was seen as pure, even though his activity was very impure. And then there was another person or description story that Bhishma Dev told of someone named Kaushika, who had taken a vow, I will always tell the truth, right, under all circumstances. And through living that vow, he developed a bit of a reputation that this person always tells the truth. People knew this. And one day, coming through the forest where he lived, some people were being chased by robbers. So they were in great fear, and they hid behind some bushes. And then the robbers came. They saw him, and they said, oh, he always tells the truth. Let's ask him. Where did they go? Tell us where they went. And maintaining that vow, he said, oh, they're behind the bushes over there. So the robbers went and brutally slaughtered these people. Right? But his action was actually condemned. Right? In one sense, he maintained dharma, but he didn't understand the subtle application of dharma. So what he did was actually a horrible thing. So that's a kind of a simple explanation. It actually gets much more complicated than that. But Bhishma's point was that dharma is not a simple thing to understand. Its application needs to be very, very carefully considered. When it's carefully considered and carefully applied, then it has very beautiful, powerful effect to help bring us to the Lord's lotus feet. When it's misapplied, it serves the exact opposite purpose. But again, if we look at this verse, we see that ultimately what it's meant to do is help us understand our own psychology to the Lord. That all these different rules and regulations, they serve this higher purpose, right? of affecting our mind in a positive way. And when the mind becomes purified, then the heart becomes a suitable place for the Lord to be established. So I will stop here. Especially because all of you people know these things much better than I. Because actually I see here the example. You know, Srila Prabhupada, he wanted Varnashram Dharma to be established. And although, actually the temple here does have a farm, but although this is maybe not the stereotypical understanding of Varnashram Dharma here in this Radha Gopinath community, because it's stuck in this modern city. But still, what we do see here is the essence of Varnashram Dharma. That people understand their place in society as a you know, brahmachari or grihastha or sannyasi or so on, and that they all understand the essence of their duties according to that, and they interact all very nicely to achieve the higher purpose of pleasing Krishna and uplifting each other together. So therefore, better that you all instruct me on this. So I'll stop here and see if there are any comments. Our questions. Thank you very much. Yes, Mataji.
Hare Krishna. One time in Srila Prabhupada's class, he mentioned that women should always wear bangles in her hand. And if she cannot afford diamonds, she should wear plastic or glass. And she should keep the greens very clean and neat. And one time His Grace Govind Prabhu mentioned that Kali resides in gold. Kali resides in gold, yeah. So devotees should not wear gold, right?
Well, right here in this verse, it was saying that she should wear gold. A chaste woman must dress nicely and decorate herself with golden ornaments for the pleasure of her husband. But that's the point right there. This is the very point, right? So on one hand, we're told Kali is there in gold. On the other hand, we're saying here, wear gold. Dharma is difficult to understand. But there's something mentioned also that we have to take note of. It's saying a chaste woman must dress nicely and decorate herself with golden ornaments for the pleasure of her husband. It's not for her own ego. Right? Ultimately, whether one wears a gold ornament or not is really not so significant. But both instructions are being given to help one. Whichever one helps one will accept, right? If a woman can wear gold ornaments in a selfless way for the pleasure of her husband or for the pleasure of God, right? Sometimes for festival, right? Women dress very nicely. They put on a nice sari and nice decoration. It's a good thing, you know, because they want to come before the Lord and say, Lord, this is your special day, so we've come dressed for your pleasure. Then that's a good thing. It uplifts the consciousness of the woman, and also it creates an atmosphere where everything's being done for the Lord's pleasure, and it's pleasing to the mind, it's pleasing to the senses, and it uplifts people's minds. But if it's done in another way, if it's done in a way that I want to attract the opposite sex, and I want to control them, manipulate them, and like this, then it serves the negative purpose. Right? So either way, and this is where we take direction from those who understand better. They understand us, they understand our psychology, particularly, and the circumstance that we're in, then they can, yes, you should wear gold. No, don't wear gold, right? They'll understand it better. So always, even in this very simple thing, one can become confused as to what's right. But the principle that lies behind them all is what brings us, our consciousness, closer to Krishna, what brings our consciousness to surrender to Krishna, we accept. And what brings our consciousness away from surrender to Krishna, we reject. It might be either one, right? And for that, we can take instruction from someone who knows us well and who knows Dharma well. Prabhu. Yes.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji. Prabhupada is mentioning in the purport that if a husband is fallen or not following regulatory principle, wife should live separate from him. Does it mean that she should take a divorce from him and live separately?
It doesn't mention that. It doesn't mention the word divorce, and it doesn't mention, in other words, at a certain time before the Lord, the husband and wife take a vow. So Prabhupada's not saying break that vow. But what he's saying is don't allow the circumstance. If living with this man is going to create a circumstance that's going to drag your consciousness away from Krishna, then separate yourself from that circumstance. Beyond that, he's not given any indication. And I wouldn't dare to do so myself.
Prabhuji, you were mentioning about dharma in activity and dharma in result. Actually, it was not clear. Please, a little bit elaborate. And there you are quoting the Bhishma example, actually. So can you little bit elaborate on that? But my another question is relating to that. When somebody takes a vow, definitely we take the vow irrespective of the consequences. So actually when you were telling, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounded like negative because there was nobody to rule. So can you speak on this?
Yeah, I want to be careful not to to say that Bhishma Dev is wrong to maintain his vow. All I'm doing is I'm trying to illustrate through that example that there are different ways to approach Dharma. That in the first case, he wanted to maintain that vow because he had made the vow. If he hadn't made that vow previously, then he would have followed Satyavati's order. But he saw Dharma in the vow itself. And he saw that as all important. So he said, I don't care if, not only do I care if there's not a king, I don't care if the entire universe collapses. I'm not going to break this vow. Right? So he's seeing the Dharma within the action or within the vow. It's a very unusual circumstance, right? But we can apply that in other ways. Right here, you see, because right here it's saying that a woman should be doing all these things. Now we can say, under all circumstances, a woman should be doing all these things. But no, there's a circumstance in which that Dharma within these activities should be set aside, and a higher Dharma to situate yourself in a situation where you're protected from a man who's not Krishna conscious, then that it becomes the higher Dharma. And so therefore the results are brought into the picture rather than the actual act. If one takes this verse and says the Dharma is in the action, then it's saying that a woman should be submissive, even if the man, under all circumstances. Right? Prabhupada's saying there's some circumstances where that we have to look beyond the Dharma within the activity and look at the Dharma within the results of the activity. And if the results are not good, and if the results aren't bringing us to surrender to the Lord, and they're bringing us in the opposite direction, then the Dharma and the result becomes more important than the Dharma and the activity. Okay. So Bhishma Dev, in his youth, he was taking that vow no matter what. Okay, we're not going to judge that. We're just going to say it shows that he considered Dharma particularly in the activity. But later in life, as he's lying on the bed of arrows, he spoke specifically on this point when Yudhishthira came to him and said, explain Dharma to me. It's difficult to understand. And he showed through these examples of this hunter and to this Kaushika that that in one case, Kaushika, he saw Dharma in the activity. I will always tell the truth. But the results are very bad. So he couldn't see the Dharma in the results. So it was an immature understanding of Dharma. And then there's the other example of a person who externally, his life seemed entirely adharmic. Right? But if you look carefully, you see actually he was very dharmic. It was very selfless, all that he was doing. You know, so both should be considered. You know? And in complicated situations, we really have to look carefully to the dharma and the result of the activity. Sometimes, what Bhishma explains is that actually sometimes the truth becomes a lie and the lie becomes a truth. It's not easy to understand. Okay, I think I've gone on too long. So I thank all of you for the opportunity to speak. Grantaraj, Srimad Bhagavatam, Ki, Srila Prabhupada, Ki.